Welcome to Ascend Radio, where we talk about some of the biggest news and issues in regulation and digital government. Today, I am happy to present a conversation with two individuals who are leading licensing reform efforts in the state of Utah. Margaret Bussey is the executive director of the Utah Department of Commerce, and Jeff Shumway is director at the state's Office of Professional Licensure Review. They join me to discuss, among other things, the unique features of licensure in Utah, how they use analytics to prioritize high-impact professions for review, and how technological changes are affecting regulation, and much, much more. Let's take a listen. Excellent. Well, first of all, thank you both for joining us today. Jeff, you're the director of the Office of Professional Licensure Review in Utah. And Margaret, you're executive director of the Utah Department of Commerce. Can each of you, and perhaps Margaret, you can start, can each of you give a little bit of background on your roles and the mandate of your department?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. It's great to be here on this day, right before the holidays. We're glad to talk about this today with you. So the Utah Department of Commerce is largely a regulatory agency. It is a full state agency. So as part of that, I'm also a member of Governor Cox's cabinet, and so advise him on various different issues, including regulatory policy. So the Department of Commerce does business and economic regulation, business regulation mostly in the form of occupational licensing, but also in the form of consumer protection. And so we house consumer protection, we house securities as well. So we have a whole investigative arm around the regulations that we enforce. And we also do the business registration function for the state of Utah. That's usually within a Secretary of State's office. We don't have that in the state of Utah. So we have it here, business registrations here. We also are an economic regulator for public utilities. So that's another aspect of what we do. But the biggest part of what we do is really this occupational licensing. And we'll talk more about this, but as it turns out, Utah's workforce, about almost 40% of it, is regulated by the state in some way. And that was a surprise to, I think, everyone, that it was that much. And so, and I know Jeff can talk more about that. But so that's kind of the department. And Jeff's office was a newly created office that we created in statute our last legislative session, which was during the winter here in Utah between January and March. And so it was placed within the Department of Commerce because we kind of are the licensing experts, if you will. So that's the Department of Commerce.
Great. I look forward to getting into all of that. There's a lot to explore there. But Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about your role?
So I'm Jeff Shumway, the director of the Office of Professional Licensing Review, which we affectionately call OPLR. And as Margaret was saying, it was just created, so it was launched in July. We've got four people, most of whom have kind of analytic, public policy, public administration backgrounds, one the master in public health. But really, I think of us as kind of a mini policy shop or analysis shop that just happens to sit within the Department of Commerce. But our client is really the legislature. So we exist to inform them, to give them good objective information and data and recommendations on occupational licensure. And as Margaret was saying, that's a little bit different from the way it's happened in the past and most other states. There are very few other offices like this across the U.S. And I think we're the only one that's actually situated like this in the executive branch, but serving the legislative branch in the way that we do. So it's a pretty unique way to do it.
Can you tell me a little bit about, every state has professional licensure to some degree. Can you tell me a little bit about its history in the state of Utah in particular?
So I don't know that the history of it in the state of Utah, at least the broad history of it, is really that different from other states. What I do know is that back in the 1950s, it was only about 5% of professions were regulated in this way through licensure. And now we have anywhere between 25 to 40% that's regulated. So it's grown a lot. And I think over the last maybe 5 to 10 years, there's been a growing, even bipartisan recognition that maybe we are over-licensed, or maybe we're not doing it the right way, and that it's holding people back from participating in the economy, and it might be driving up costs and decreasing access to those professional services. And so Utah in the past probably 5 years has actually been very progressive in looking at how we can loosen up some of our licensing, or at least make it easier for people to work. And so some examples of that are a couple of years ago, there was a law passed to allow to make sure that when previously incarcerated individuals are coming out and trying to rejoin the workforce, that they are not prohibited from every kind of licensure, whereas before they were. Now it's sort of more targeted to the type of crime they may have committed. So it loosens that up a lot. That was kind of seen as being very, very much on the vanguard. Another thing that Utah did is it created a law called licensing by endorsement, which basically said that if we have similar regulations to another state for a particular profession, for a doctor, for a cosmetologist, for a real estate agent, then instead of having that person, if they come to our state, instead of having them redo all their licensure and go through all the training and all the requirements and everything, we just simply say, we endorse that license from the other state. You can go ahead and start working. So we have done some things to loosen things up. We also just passed a law our last legislative session to allow people coming in from foreign countries to basically have a pathway to get a license in our state to be able to work, so that they can work to the top of their abilities. Oftentimes people come in, you know, it's the proverbial taxi driver in New York that you meet that was a doctor in Bangladesh, and they can't practice, right? So we're creating a pathway for those individuals as well.
And I would add two other things that are, I think, unique in Utah. One is, and this is really relevant since the North Carolina dental opinion from the Supreme Court, but our boards, our licensing boards, do not have authority to do licensing on their own. They are advisory to the Division of Occupational, or the Division of Professional Licensure, which is under Margaret. So in that sense, the state has always done the regulation with advice from the licensed professionals, which, you know, again, that predates the NC Dental decision, but it put us in a good spot relative to that decision. The other thing I would mention is, you know, Margaret was talking about this expansion. About 5% of all workers were regulated in the 50s. Now the estimate is about 22%. That comes from surveys, right? And that's the number that people use. I think it comes from Morris Kleiner, and it's quoted in the Obama White House Treasury report on occupational licensing. We did an internal census. So rather than a survey where we went on and asked people, are you licensed? We did a census of the licenses across the entire executive branch in Utah. About 55% of all licenses come out of commerce, and so we had good data on that. Then we went out to the other executive branch agencies that do certifications, other regulation. And so it's a complete sentence, a census, right? It's not, it doesn't have sampling error in the same way. I'm sure it has some error. Right. We actually came out to about 38% of the workforce that was regulated in some way. And of course, we're including things like food handlers permits and commercial driver's licenses and things like that. But I think it's really telling that the survey data and the internal census come up with quite different numbers, because a lot of people don't think of, you know, their food handler's permit or their cosmetology license potentially as occupational regulation, so they don't respond that way. But internally, we actually know it's quite a high number, and most people aren't using that number. They're using the 22-25%.
And Paul, I think this gets us to that idea of kind of the unseen economic force of professional licensing. Because people, maybe they understand for their profession they have to get a license, but they don't often understand the breadth of the regulation on workforce and how that affects our entire economy. So it has implications for higher ed, right? Because if you have certain requirements to be a social worker or a cosmetologist or whatever it is, those are the requirements that higher ed programs are going to then create. So that they have a vested interest in those requirements. And if you want to lower them or change them, it disrupts them and it can disrupt their business model, right? And similarly, just for a lot of the medical licenses, the way that the scopes are articulated for those licenses and the way that the requirements that to receive a license dictate in some way if you have to have people supervising other people. And so it actually affects business models as well. So it has licensing has this massive economic consequence in our society that I think has gone underappreciated.
So what were some of the first signs that over-licensure might be a thing in the States? The first signs that sort of drove towards the creation of the Office of Professional Licensure?
So I think there were a couple things, Paul. I think there are some professions that people for a few years now have been sort of questioning, why are we regulating this? And Governor Cox, his first executive order when he took over as governor in January of 2021 was actually to order all of his state agencies, all the executive branch agencies, to look at any professional licensure that they do and see where they could reduce barriers, because he appreciated that oftentimes these requirements that come along with the regulation are keeping people out of professions, particularly professions that don't require as much training. So the example that always comes up is cosmetology. So if you think about it, why do we regulate professions? Well, the reason that that states have an interest in it, in theory, right, is to protect public health and safety. And that can include financial safety, right? We regulate securities and professionals as well. But people are sort of looking around and saying, you know, I don't know that there's a lot of risk, a safety risk when I go to a cosmetologist, you know, to get my hair cut, right? And if there is, maybe it's just around lice. And that can be training that's done in 10 hours and not 1500 hours at a beauty school, right? So I think that was kind of the example that stuck out to people. It's also a profession that otherwise doesn't require as much training. And so if you were to loosen that up, it would be a way for people to get into that profession and provide economic opportunity. So that's where we've seen a lot of kind of one-off reforms in Utah. But what also was happening is what I saw when I came into this job is that there were a lot of these kind of one-off reforms, sometimes propelled by a change in practice, sometimes propelled by just an ideological preference, whatever it was. And what we kind of realized is, you know, we need a more systematic approach to this. We know we're probably overall over-licensed, but we're just doing it piecemeal and in kind of an unorganized way. And so the idea was to, and also that can be hard for the industry because, again, so much is built up around what these licensure requirements are. So we wanted to be able to give industry more of an expected process. We wanted to make sure that through this review process that's now housed in this office would also be able to keep our regulations relevant. You know, there's all sorts of things that happen in professions that change. Technology changes professions. Does that need to change the requirements that we have? Does it need to change the scope of practice that we have? So it's a way for us to be relevant. And third, it's really just a way for us to start unleashing some reform in professional licensing.
Did you have any models that you looked at in the creation of the department? You know, you're sort of entering uncharted territory for the state at that point, and you have to figure out a way to go about it. Did you look to other states? Did you look to anywhere else in the world? How did you design that approach?
Yeah, it's a great question. We did look around. We did a lot of kind of benchmarking. We talked to organizations that are there at the national level that are very familiar with licensure, like the Institute of Justice and some other organizations like that. We have a state think tank that does a lot of intellectual work about licensing. We talked to them. We did look at a couple of states. Vermont and Colorado have something a little bit similar, but we wanted to kind of learn from what they felt like wasn't working as much and what could work better. And then we did a ton of stakeholder outreach, tons of it, to understand how we could best craft the office to make it most effective. And so it was a lot of work to try to put together what we hope will be the model for the country. And then, you know, Jeff has come in and he's the one that's been developing, well, how do we go about the analytics of looking at different professions and how do we decide which professions to review first? We have a mandate to review. The office has a mandate to review every profession in the state of Utah that's regulated every 10 years. Well, which ones do we do first? I mean, is it just sort of like alphabetical? We didn't want to do that. We wanted to make it more impactful. And so Jeff can talk more about that.
Yeah, I'm very curious about that, like whether it was based on a risk approach or an impact approach. Jeff, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, well, and I have to come clean here. My background is not in government. I'm new to this. I'm a social impact consultant, a social impact strategist by training. And so I've been doing that for 20 years. So my natural inclination was to come in and say, where's the biggest impact going to be for the Utah public? The other thing that was clear to me is I didn't want to be doing this kind of one-off. I wanted to be doing groups of occupations where we could get some expertise, you know, build a network of people to draw on and be smart. And so there are some natural groupings of occupations that are high impact. So if you think of, you know, medical doctors and dentists and everything related, you think of nursing and everything related, trades are actually really important because of the shortages going on right now. But the one we landed on was actually mental health and behavioral health. But each of those is a natural kind of grouping that would let us, you know, get up to speed on how the system works. So we looked at impact. I'm trying to go back a couple months now. We looked at impact in a couple of ways. One is how many active licensees are there? So how big is it in the economy? How many substantiated complaints are there against that occupation? Because we wanted to have some proxy for harm. Do we think there's harm to the public going on here? And then we also looked at projected job openings into the future, using kind of the BLS data collected by our Department of Workforce Services. And so that gave us some quantitative measures to say what's important in the market, in the community. And then we also did a lot of subjective work, talking to legislators, talking to other members of the community to say, what are people ready to move on, right? What's going to get traction? Because we don't want to do all this analytical work and reform work and then write a report that doesn't cause any change. And so that combination, it led to this massive bubble chart of all the occupations sized by how many active licensees there are, and we placed them on an axis for active, for substantiated complaints and then projected job openings. And that helped us a little bit, but really in the end, it was more the subjective stuff that told us this was where to look immediately, because talking to legislators and others, this is a really big deal in Utah. We have high prevalence of mental illness, high prevalence of suicides, especially among youth, and it's just not consistent with kind of Utah values to let that happen. So it was really important to do that right off the bat. I should say this too. There's this movement within people thinking about professional licensure reform to hack away at kind of the undergrowth. So the professions that really shouldn't be licensed, that should just be certified or registered. And those are easy to go after because a lot of times they're
hair threading comes to mind as an example.
And Utah's been through that, right? And cosmetologists tend to take it on the chin all the time around this stuff. I think that's interesting, and that needs to be done. What's more interesting to me is in these high-value occupations that are critical to the functioning of society that we know need some regulation of some sort, how do you get the balance right? We're not saying you need to unlicense a psychologist. We're saying we need to figure out the balance between protection from harm and adequate supply of competent, trained individuals. And so that balance is actually trickier in that context for a doctor, for a nurse, for a mental health therapist than it is, I think, for some of the others that we talk about a lot.
And again, what the state is trying to do or should be trying to do is protect the public from harm. So licensure shouldn't necessarily be a proxy for quality. That can be done in a different way. Right? That's not necessarily the state's interest to ensure quality. And that's where I think it sometimes gets muddled. Let me say a couple more things about what Jeff has been doing, which I think has just been really brilliant. I don't know how much he sort of reemphasized the point of by taking, there's a bunch of different licenses in this mental health group. How many do we have? Like 15 or 20 that you're looking at, Jeff?
We're looking at about 15, yeah.
So the idea is that instead of just looking at, okay, we're going to look at these 15 licenses, license types, and one's going to be, you know, a plumbing one, and one's going to be a family therapist, and one's going to be a cosmetologist, we're going to group them all together so that he can do a system level analysis on how to improve this profession, give the public more access to the profession, potentially reduce costs to the public. But in order to do that, taking them all together, all the related licensures is what enables him to do that, right? And then he can look at the higher ed programs and the, you know, staffing ratios and all of that, because it can be done in a systematic approach. And we have a critical need. We are in a mental health crisis, not just Utah, the entire country. We have a mental health counselor shortage right now. So this is something that is ripe for disruption. You know, maybe we need to create a lower level license so that that sort of has fewer requirements that people with lower level problems can access, that where there's no access at all right now. And so so that's what I think the approach is really going to be, have a dramatic effect on Utah and the services that it houses and the economic forces.
Does priority mean exclusivity to any degree? In prioritizing the professions to go after, does that mean you're attacking one at a time? Or is there a broader approach as you go about the review?
I mean, in our case, we really are going at it one at a time. So the way the statute is set up, it's set up that we have to go occupation by occupation. So that's the unit of analysis. And we have to review everything, or each occupation, once every 10 years. So by prioritizing this first, we're not saying we won't do the others. We have to in statute. So we'll hit everything within a 10-year cycle. This is just to say, where is there urgency? Where is there demand? Where is there legislative traction and agreement to make a change?
Have you come across any surprising findings in your work so far?
Oh, man. So many. I've learned a ton. I mean, I'm new to government and I'm new to licensing. I've done a lot of work in workforce development and social determinants of health and things like that. But I'm learning a tremendous amount. So, for instance, the whole idea, and this goes to the unseen force, right? The whole idea that licensure is largely driven by licensed practitioners, by those who are in the profession, I don't think I knew that. I mean, I knew it at some level, but I hadn't thought about the economic consequences of that. You know, the way licensure has developed in the U.S., it's essentially an extension of the guild, right? And that licensing boards actually have, you know, up until NC Dental, have quite a bit of power to regulate in whatever way they see fit. I don't think I had fully understood that. So going back through and reading the statutes here in Utah to say, okay, where is that in statute? How is that done in statute? And are there places where we need to make clear the public interest in licensure? That's been really fascinating to me, to see how these levers of power within statute and rule and policy of the state have been used to do that. And in a lot of cases, I think it's clearly to the benefit of the Utah public. I'm not saying that this is all protectionism. I don't think that's actually what's driving most of it. I think much of it comes from a place of wanting to have integrity of the profession and high quality within your profession, which is admirable and good and serves the public well. But the balance of the public need for access to these professionals and services is really interesting. That's not represented in statute and in rule in the same way that some of the other pieces are. So that's been fascinating for me. And then as we go down into mental health, there's a bunch of stuff about mental health practice and systems that I'm learning every day that's fascinating. But that's a big, hairy, complicated system, you know, in and of itself.
So let me reemphasize that point, Paul, because I think this is a key point and a key insight coming from Jeff and his office, which is that oftentimes the regulations, they're coming from industry themselves. And again, it's not always a nefarious thing that they're just trying to be protectionist, although we know that their evidence suggests that as requirements go up and for licensing, wages go up for those licensed professionals, which means costs go up for the people trying to get them, right? Because it makes it harder to get in. But it's not always done for nefarious reason. It might be just like, oh, you know, we want to make sure that we protect that individual patient from harm. And so we're going to increase the amount of requirements on that practitioner so that we have a more of a guarantee that that patient, in this case, is not harmed. But what they're not taking into account is that when you do that, you're now potentially blocking people from getting into the profession. So now you might be putting the rest of the public at risk because they can't access those services because there's not enough. And I think mental health is a perfect example of that. There are not enough practitioners. And so it's causing a crisis. Well, somebody was just focusing on the one patient versus the whole public. So changing the orientation is really, really important that I think has not really been thought through. And even in Utah, as Jeff said, we have a different structure where our boards are not the regulatory boards. They are advising boards, and they do play a very important role, and we rely on their expertise, but they don't ultimately make the final decision on what regulations and rules and so forth.
It sounds like mental health is a far-reaching conversation, but just briefly, and I hate to oversimplify, but why is there such a practitioner shortage in the state right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are, so if you think about what it takes to become a medical doctor, it takes about 10 years, right? A bachelor's, medical school, internship, residency, et cetera. And then you can have subspecialties and board certifications, which are separate from state licensure. But you're talking about 10 years. To become a master's level mental health therapist, someone who can diagnose, create a treatment plan, do mental health therapy under Medicaid, under public insurance, that takes 8. And for a psychologist, it takes 10. So we're essentially saying you have to have the same level of training for mental health therapy that you do for, surgery and other medical practices. I don't know if that's appropriate or not, but that's a high bar. That takes a long time to create someone. They come out of school with a certain amount of debt, and we're paying them a lot less than we pay doctors. And so there's sort of a cost-benefit analysis there that doesn't quite square up. And that has to do with choices we're making around how we reimburse mental health services. Commercial insurance is even worse than Medicaid and Medicare in terms of its provision of mental health and how it reimburses mental health. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there that has to do with reimbursement and payers and so on. There's also the higher ed question. So in Utah, at least, there's this fascinating situation where if you go to the technical colleges, every single one of them, I'm thinking of the public technical colleges, they have certificates and associates in trades. They have tons of them in nursing and phlebotomy, all these things. I just did kind of a quick survey. There is one associate's degree in social work. That's about it, right? We don't have the certificates, the associates, and not many people are going through a bachelor's of social work. And yet social workers are the vast majority of those providing mental health services and behavioral health services, especially at the master's level in the state. And so we've done a little bit of a disservice, I think, by not doing appropriate outreach and making clear where the public need is for people coming through higher ed. So I think people come in thinking they're interested in mental health and they go into psychology. But once you go into psychology, you can't do an advanced standing master's, which cuts off a year. So there's all these sort of funky things in the higher ed system that are actually slowing us down or not drawing people into appropriate courses from the beginning. And then, of course, there's just the fact that it's a really hard job, and the turnover and the burnout and the burden, especially in the public mental health system, is quite high. What were you going to say, Margaret?
I was just saying, from a broader economic perspective, it's hard for the, quote unquote, market forces to work well when you have a regulation. So that prevents sort of the market clearing mechanism of like, wow, there's a lot more demand, so there's going to be more supply. Right. Now, in this case, I think there's also need that doesn't always translate into demand, meaning need is where people need it, but they don't always have the funds to pay for it. And that's another problem as well. But when you have the regulation, it sort of hampers the market forces from working as they would normally work.
Well, and this whole market is a fake market, right? Like, especially the public side, Medicare, Medicaid, they're not a free market, right? It's all dictated by the reimbursement rates and the billing codes and so on. And we get that. And so a lot of this is about regulatory choices that are made in other offices and other branches and at the federal level too. So it's a tricky and complicated place to navigate.
Can you give me any other notable examples? I think you've alluded to a few of where existing licensure requirements became evidently particularly out of date. or erroneous or unnecessary?
I mean, one that jumps, and Jeff, you can ask this too, but one that jumps to mind, I think everyone can relate to, is telehealth, right? So there used to be some strict requirements about what doctors and other healthcare providers could and couldn't do, and that they had to provide services in office, you know? And I think the pandemic sort of disrupted that, as we all know well, that, you know what, it actually looks like telehealth can be viable and that people should be able to do that. And it opens up services for people. And now I can access, you know, a doctor in New York in ways that I couldn't before. And so that's an example. A lot of times it's technology that is bringing about changes and our regulations are behind. Another example, and sometimes, you know, the hours that are set for certain training, they're a little bit arbitrary. It's like, is it 1,500 or 2,000 that makes someone safer? You know, I don't know. Maybe those marginal 500 hours are very, you know, diminishing returns in terms of helping safety, but they cost a lot of money. And so that actually happened with our cosmetology regulation. This was a few years ago, where it used to be 2,000 hours to become a cosmetologist. They reduced it to 1,500. But results from this office are still to be determined. That's what the analysis is going through right now.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add is, you know, I'm thinking about our governor who recently reinforced the idea that within the state of Utah, within state agencies, we don't require degrees, right? You can prefer a degree, but we believe in competency-based hiring. I'm really curious to see how that flows through licensing. You know, I believe in education, but I also believe that people have skills and competencies and experience that don't get captured well in their educational background. We're thinking about licensing exams in the same way. Is it too much to require accreditation of a higher ed program and a degree and a licensing exam, maybe two, you know, before you become fully licensed? Is that belt and suspenders? Is that redundant? There's a bunch of legislators who push really hard every session for competency-based licensing rather than time-based experiential or supervision hours, things like that. So there's a bunch of these moves that we've seen other states making that we're going to be thinking about, but all that is in keeping up with the times and kind of how we view education, exams, supervision, and all those kinds of things. I'm thinking, of course, of the mental health occupations right now.
When you mentioned one industry going from, you know, 2,000 down to 1,500 hours of requirements, I'm wondering, when you're trying to make those modifications, given the requirements came from presumably a need in the first place, what kind of friction do you run into, or rather, how do you overcome the barriers when you're trying to make those changes?
We'll tell you when we figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think so that particular change, it came before my time. It was just, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And it was a legislative change. And what I do know from that was, you know, there was a lot of pushback from industry, and not really practitioners as much as the schools, right? So the beauty schools sort of say, well, if you're reducing those hours, that means that we can, that people will only want potentially 1,500 hours. And now, so that reduces revenue for us. So that kind of speaks to that, what we were talking about earlier, about how all this licensing, it's not just, it doesn't stand independently. It's linked to all sorts of different things that have made modifications to build up around the licensing. And it is disruptive. You know, you build a program around the licensing requirements, and now you're saying we're changing them. And so you see those kinds of stakeholders come out, and I know that they did enforce. But it was a legislative decision.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing. The natural constituency for licensing is the industry themselves, you know, as we've talked about. I think there are other natural constituencies, but they don't necessarily get brought into the process as much. So consumer groups, you know, people who care about mental health and suicide prevention and others, they care a lot about this and they may have different views. The providers who have to do the staffing and the supervision and are looking for the balance of an adequate supply and good quality, they're a natural constituency, right? And so we're trying to draw them into the process. The insurance folks, both the public programs, but also commercial. They have an interest in getting this right. So I think there's a bunch of constituencies out there that we don't usually bring into licensing because it's largely done between, you know, the industry association, an industry-driven board, and the legislature. And actually, I think there's a much broader conversation to be had with a lot more stakeholders to say, okay, what do we need? And once you get those people engaged, I think the conversation quickly turns away from, you know, how can we make treatment better for those we're treating to what is the need of the whole community? And that's a really healthy shift, I think.
And particularly in healthcare, you know, we all know that our healthcare system is in crisis and that the costs are way too high and that the quality and the outcomes are not great. We're not getting good quality healthcare for what we're paying for it. I'm talking about writ large in across our country. One of the initiatives of Governor Cox, he created this One Utah Health Collaborative, which is trying to get together all the stakeholders in the health ecosystem to come up with solutions to reduce cost and increase access and improve outcomes. And of course, one of the pieces to that puzzle is healthcare workforce and healthcare licensure. And, you know, that's, I think, a piece, again, that often gets overlooked as an economic driver of some of the costs.
Any other states that you've seen regulatory moves in around streamlining licensure that you've found to be particularly either inspiring or, you know, something that you'd use a model or would want to replicate?
I guess I can speak to the narrow version because I'm looking at mental health. There's some interesting things going on in a couple of states right now. So a lot of folks right now are worried about licensure exams, specifically for social work. So there's a big brouhaha right now about kind of disparate outcomes on the National Association of Social Workers, the ASWB, the board that runs the licensure exam for most states. And that's causing a lot of people to get creative. And so there are some states, I'm thinking of Texas, which says if you fail that exam, but within 5 points of passing, within 5 percentage points of passing, you can move on and become fully licensed if you get an extra layer of supervision, and then your supervisor can sign off. So they call this provisional licensing. And there's a couple of states that either have gone to provisional licensing or have tried doing away with that exam. And so there's this interesting natural experiment where you can look at how many people got licensed in the years running up to it, and then how many got licensed right when they released that requirement. And so we're seeing like a doubling in some cases, in those states where they got rid of the licensing exam requirement. So that's really fascinating for us to be able to look at and say, okay, how do we want to think about this? Let's see. The other one that I think is fascinating is Nebraska did something really interesting where they took a whole bunch of all the master's level mental health therapists and essentially said, you all have roughly the same scope of practice, at least in terms of health and safety. So we're just going to call it one thing. You're all going to be licensed professional therapists or licensed clinical therapists. But then you have a voluntary right to title. So you can bring your licensing exam, your degree, and say, I want to be registered or certified as a social worker. And no one else can call themselves a social worker. So they've streamlined the actual licensure, but then they've still allowed right to title within the occupations. And I think that's a really fascinating way to think about it. Say, this is one whole scope of practice. It's not three different occupations. We're going to do it all together, but then still provide for that kind of title protection in some way that's a much lower bar.
I mean, it may be a little bit trite to say that, you know, states are the laboratories of democracy, but I think, you know, in this case, they really are. And it gives us an amazing opportunity for these sort of natural experiments, essentially, for this new office to look at. And so benchmarking other states is really going to be an important part of the analysis. You know, if it turns out that, you know, X state isn't even licensing this profession at all and they've seen no harmful consequences, well, that might tell us something, right? And so that's, I think it's actually fantastic that we have access to what these different states are doing. I think we talked a little bit before in terms of the overall approach. We know that Colorado and Vermont have somewhat similar kind of reviews, but there's still some differences. I think Texas might have something that looks more regulations, not just occupational licensure, but other kinds of regulations that they're doing, kind of regulatory reviews on. The key that we think is really important is the analytical approach. It is the collaborative approach between the legislature and the executive branch, and is the resourced approach. So many times, you know, states will sort of say, we're going to do a regulatory review, and maybe there's some temporary resources that are put towards that, but it's not an ongoing sort of systematic resourced approach. And I think that's what's key.
It's funny you mention that, because I was going to ask whether the department was a department of continuous improvement, in constant monitoring, or whether it had a finite goal or outcome that it sought to achieve, or I could also say, what is the goal of the department?
Yeah, so our office is ongoing. Right. So that periodic review that happens every 10 years, that will keep cycling. So we assume that life is going to change and the needs are going to change enough that will be required once every 10 years. So it's not just a one shot review. It will persist.
Again, because we need to keep our regulations relevant. The biggest problem any kind of regulation runs into is it becomes irrelevant. When you have a regulation. This is any kind of regulation that it has become out of date because new technology has come into play or whatever it is, then you're just hampering something for no good reason. It may no longer be doing anything to protect the public. It's just creating pure economic waste. And so, every regulation, there should be a regulatory process, an ongoing regulatory review process really for everything, in my view. But it's hard to do. It takes time, and there's not the same kind of, competitive forces that exist in the private sector. So the only competitive force we have is maybe comparing to other states. We want to be in Utah. We like to be regulatory light. So we might be doing that for that reason. But otherwise, there's not a lot of incentive to be looking at your regulations unless you're just really committed to it. Or if it comes up on a one-off basis because somebody brings it up. But I think there's a lot of economic waste that resides in lots of types of regulation. Again, it's not doing any good to protect the public. It's just sitting there to hamper the economy.
A couple of times you've mentioned technology rendering things out of date. I'm wondering if you can give me an example of that.
So we talked a little bit about telehealth. Another thing that the legislature has been kind of contemplating and looked at this past legislative session is that there's some new kind of device that allows somebody, it's easier to use to perform certain kinds of eye surgeries. Okay, so this is just like a very niche advice. A niche example. And the question was, always it was only trained MDs, ophthalmologists that could perform this type of procedure. And optometrists that have a lower level of training were arguing, hey, we actually think that now with this new technology, our training is adequate for us to be able to perform this procedure, right? Now, ultimately, the legislature decided against that. It will probably come back up again. But that's an example of how there's new technology. Maybe you need to change the scope of practice, potentially, and you could lower the requirements of someone being able to do that procedure. What does that mean for the consumer? That means a lower cost, right? And so if you're not doing that, then you're, again, it's the economic waste.
What about the future of the department? Clearly there's this deep work in mental health right now, and you've gone over your other priorities. What do the next few years for the department look like?
Jeff, you want to talk about what the office is thinking?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, there's sort of some natural groupings of occupations that I think are high impact. And so our plan is to propose one of those every year for the legislature, and they have to approve what we do, right? We can propose it, but then there's an interim committee that approves that. So we're going to propose one of those every year for the next 4 or 5 years. And then beyond that, the groupings sort of tend to fall apart, and there's lots more kind of ad hoc, bundling that would go on. But, I expect that we would continue looking at, large groupings, so like trades, cosmetology, nursing, doctors and physicians, and that we would do those in whatever order made sense, given the appetite of the legislature and others to take them on.
How do you measure the success? How do you measure the performance of the department?
Well, that is a great question. So we have a research manager who just finished a PhD in management, but specifically in occupational identity. And so this is one of the first questions she asked was, so how are we going to know if we get it right? Now, I think it's probably too much for us to say that we can pull levers on licensing and we're going to see mental illness burden go down in the state, or even mental health access go down in the state. But access is really what we're looking at now for mental health, to say, could we do something that actually improved access? There's a bunch of points along the way that I think we would like to measure and see how we do on. And so just looking at the throughput of licensees within these occupations, given that we're in a time of shortage over the next couple of years, that would be a good indication. Seeing uptake of new licensure pathways, if that's where we end up going, or new, sort of sub-licenses that had a lower educational or experience requirement. So looking at the uptake of those licenses and then the throughput of those licenses, I think will be something we would look at.
Well, and the other thing is that this new office will propose recommendations to the legislature, and it's not our choice whether or not they get adopted. Of course, we'll work hard to help them get it adopted, and I presume that we'll have the governor's support on that, but that is up to the legislature to make policy changes. Now, to the extent that some of these policy changes could be made in rule, then our department, the Department of Commerce, has that ability to make those changes. But ones that require statutory change is up to the legislature. So there's some exogenous forces too, obviously. Yeah.
That's the first thing we want to measure, is the uptake of our recommendations, because I think that's a good sign that our stakeholder engagement is doing what it should as we go through the process.
And speaking of stakeholders, we talked about that. There are a lot here. And there are people, and some of these stakeholders are nervous because, this could be disruptive to their industry, and which is why that kind of engagement is really important. And we engaged heavily with these kinds of stakeholders, even in just the creation and the design of the office. So
on that note, I'm glad you brought that up again. If a new state, had no existing professional licensure review, we're beginning the process, based on your lessons learned on your design and implementation of the office, what would you tell them as they build their plan?
Stakeholder outreach is really important. Making sure there's a really robust mechanism to have a partnership with the legislature, because ultimately, like we just talked about, they need to be able to make the policy changes. They are the ones that will make the statutory changes. So making sure you have connections with the legislature, both formally through the actual creation of the office, but also informally. And, we've done a lot of working with the legislature, individual legislators, even as Jeff has come on board, to make sure that people understand the purpose of the office and we're hearing their concerns and ideas and things like that. So those are really important things. And I think getting the analytics right. I think Jeff's done an amazing job of trying to figure out how do we approach this? What are the right metrics to be looking at? And how do we prioritize the licenses to be reviewed?
Yeah, that's really well said. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's good that we're aligned, since Margaret's my boss.
I want to talk a little bit more about foreign credentialing and what I know we touched on it a couple times, but You know, you mentioned the proverbial cabbie example. We see it everywhere. We see it all over the U.S., all over Canada, too. What has that undertaking looked like? And what sort of outcomes would be desirable there?
Yeah, great question. And so we're still so, this is very nascent for us because the law went into effect not very long ago, just a few months ago. So we've just done some hiring to build some capacity to do this. But the idea, of course, is that, as we talked about earlier, is that we know we have a lot of folks coming in from other countries, immigrants, refugees, and so forth, that are potentially very highly skilled. And are often not being able to work at the top of their training. And then on the other side of it, we know we have a labor shortage like across the economy, obviously in certain professions more acutely, but across the economy. So it's sort of silly that we are not thinking about how to do it, but it's kind of hard to do too, because you're trying to say from any country, well, what were their requirements to be a doctor, to be a nail technician, to be a cosmetologist, to be a construction worker. We have to then look at that, understand how those compare with what we require, and then figure out what the sort of the delta of training is. Does that make sense? So it does take quite a bit of work, but we wanted to take that on because it's a waste for our economy not to be utilizing these people. And so just interestingly, we've started with sort of professions that are and countries that we're seeing a lot of folks from. So we had a lot of refugees come in from Afghanistan. Now we're seeing them from Ukraine. And so we're looking at those countries specifically and some of their requirements. Specifically with refugees, it can be very difficult because they often have to leave their country in distress and they don't have any forms of certification, you know, that they can bring with them. And so then there might be competency tests involved. So a very specific example, our family has actually been involved in sponsoring a Ukrainian refugee family to come over here. And the mother in that family had some training in doing nails. So we're actually trying to figure out how do we get her license as a nail technician. And because we have this new statute that allows us to do it, there is a path. So we're in the process of helping her to do just that right now.
A very good example of the turnaround on your efforts. What do these reviews finally, and I just wanted to take it to a commerce angle, if you will, what do these reviews mean for business in Utah?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for businesses that are employing lots of licensed individuals, I think it means that they will hopefully be able to have access to more individuals because more individuals will be able to become licensed, and it will free up their ability to do business.
And I would just say, you know, Margaret's talking about the direct effect on businesses that use licensed individuals. There's also the indirect effect. So Utah is growing much faster than other states, than the national average. There's a lot of in-migration.
Growing state in the last
right. Yep. We've been a growing state for a long, long time. And a lot of that is because of the lifestyle, because of the economy, because of the outdoors, a bunch of those things. We need to get this right for secondary reasons so that people still want to move here, still want to start businesses here, want to stay here. And so providing, you know, medical services, having people who can do trades, having cosmetologists, having mental health professionals makes it a good place to live. And so we want to get it right for that secondary reason too.
Right. Do either of you have any final thoughts before we wrap up on anything we've discussed or the unseen force of professional licensure in the state?
Well, I really like that unseen force phrase because I think it has started to get increasing attention, but I think that people just have not realized as licensure has crept up the overall effects on the economy. And I really feel like one of the missions of this office, you know, it'll be reviewing individual types of licenses, but it's also going to be uncovering the economic effects on our society.
For me, it reminds me, you know, because I've been living and breathing licensure every day. It reminds me that before I got into this world, I really didn't think about licensure as a dimension of daily life and public
protection. Nor did I. Nor did Jeff.
Well, and I guess my last thought would be, I think there's an opportunity to turn licensure on its head. I mean, if you think about the way licensing runs, you have delegated authority from the state down to occupational level boards that then oversee occupations. When I search for mental health services, I'm looking for someone who can see me, someone who can diagnose, assess, someone who can prescribe what my child needs. We need elements of a scope of practice, and yet we're regulating occupations. And those occupations are not the same thing as the elements that a consumer is looking for. If you turn it on its head, what really matters is, do we have enough prescribers? Do we have enough people to do diagnosis? Do we have enough people to do therapy, to do counseling, to do case management? And when you flip it on its head and think about it from the consumer's point of view, suddenly things sort of fall into place. You say, okay, what do we need? What does the community need? And then how do we make licensing follow that? And by taking that perspective, it's caused me to question all sorts of things I'm finding in the way we do licensing. And again, that's been really fun for me, but hopefully it will be really impactful for the Utah public to say, what does the consumer need and how should that drive what we do with licensing?
Right. That's great. Well, this has been an enlightening conversation for me. I'm always excited to talk about licensure reform because I feel that there's a sweet spot in the middle of the over-licensure, de-licensure, pro-licensure, anti-licensure debate. And it's nice to see movements being made at the state level. So thank you both.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about the movements around professional licensure reform or stay abreast of professional licensing, digital government and regulation at large, head over to our website at ascend.thentia.com and be sure to subscribe to our Week in Brief, which is a weekly rundown of the latest news in professional licensing and digital government. As always, thanks for listening, and till next time, stay informed and stay safe.